Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, bringing us the news, maybe asking a question or two as we slowly transition to having Carl as the host. For people who are just learning that now, I'm going to be leaving the program, but Carl will be taking over full-time shortly.
I've been taking lessons to imitate Lauren's voice.
So on today's program, I'm really excited to speak with our guest. We're speaking with Kimberly Carroll, who is a television host and producer. She's done shows on the W Network, CBC Television and Radio, CTV, among others. But what we're talking to her today about is not her extensive media career, but her coordination of the Why Love One But Eat the Other Toronto subway ad campaign. So for people who are in Toronto, you might have been on the subways recently and seen these very provocative posters that show an animal that I guess many North Americans tend to love more. So a kitten or a dog. And then that's juxtaposed right beside with an animal that we tend to eat and put through pretty terrible conditions in industrial agriculture. And so to kind of look at some of the disjunctures between the way that we think about animals and some of the hypocrisy that's really in there. And then there's images of factory farms below those two images. So it's really strange to see that kind of imagery in the Toronto subway, I guess, terminals and on the cars. And so we wanted to find out more about this campaign, the motivations, who's been involved. There's kind of a mysterious little note on the posters that say that it's through a group called Mercy for Animals, which is a group in the United States, but there's also a group of Toronto concerned citizens that put together the posters. So we'll find out about who those people are through Kimberly Carroll. But before we do that and find out all about the campaign, we're going to hear some news.
Thank you, Lauren. The first piece of news today coming to us from the Agence France-Presse. The headline is, Questions Mount Over Jackson Animal Kingdom. Besides leaving a musical legacy, Michael Jackson orphaned an array of exotic pets, with some of them unaccounted for, and even his beloved chimpanzee Bubbles, depending on donations. In what was once seen mostly as a harmless eccentricity, Jackson, at the height of his stardom, amassed a private zoo of giraffes, tigers, and other foreign animals at Neverland, his sprawling fantasy estate in California. Nearly all of the animals have been moved to new homes in the past few years, as Jackson's personal and financial woes worsened, with animal rights activists saying some have become roadside attractions in uncertain conditions. Bubbles, once the world's best-known ape, who slept in the superstar's bedroom and mastered his moonwalk dance, has lived since 2005 at the Center for Great Apes in Florida, the head of the sanctuary said. Jackson did not provide financial support for Bubbles, and despite his stated desire, never visited him there, said Patty Reagan, director of the Center for Great Apes. While Bubbles remains high profile, animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals said it was hard to track down most of Jackson's former pets. Lisa Wathney, PETA's specialist in captive exotic animals, voiced particular concern about two of Jackson's orangutans sent to a private owner in Connecticut and reptiles at a roadside zoo in Oklahoma. She said Jackson's case showed why wild animals should not be kept as pets. Quote, all too often, even people who start with good intentions, as Michael Jackson certainly did, don't have the ability to properly care for these animals, she said. And unfortunately, in Michael Jackson's case, he did apparently run into financial problems that ultimately led to his animals being dispersed to places all over the world. We don't know, frankly, where most of them ended up. PETA, in January 2006, complained to U.S. authorities that animals were being mistreated in Neverland. The authorities inspected the estate's menagerie but found no evidence of abuse or neglect. Jackson's two tigers, Thriller and Sabu, were taken in at a sanctuary in California run by former actress Tippi Hedren. And the next piece of news coming to us from thestatesman.com. The headline is, For some local Jews, kosher isn't enough. Ethics of food production is key part of ethical kashrut. Malka Dubrovsky and her husband, Robert Trent, decided to go vegetarian after she heard a radio show about mad cow disease, she said. By keeping a vegetarian diet, she and her husband are also keeping kosher, a Jewish dietary law spelled out in the Torah that prohibits mixing meat with dairy and requires that birds and mammals be slaughtered in a way that ensures they do not suffer. Quote, eating that way makes you more mindful, Dubrowski, a freelance textile designer, said. Just like in Judaism, what you say to and about people is very important. It's really bad to deride people or insult them. What you put in your mouth is as important as what comes out of it. Dubrowski and Trent, both 42, are part of a trend among Jews to combine their religious views with the goal of consuming local organic food. Called ethical kashrut, it's the idea that adherence to Jewish dietary law is as important as the ethics and social justice involved in creation and processing of food. A major catalyst for Jews who now practice ethical kashrut was a scandal at Agriprocessors Incorporated, the largest provider of kosher meat in the United States. May 12th marked the anniversary of federal immigration raids at the Postville, Iowa company, where 389 immigrants were arrested in the Bush administration's largest crackdown on illegal workers at a single site. For years, the company faced allegations of worker abuse and violations of labor laws. It was also criticized over code violations and slaughtering practices not in line with kosher rules to minimize animal suffering. The discussions prompted by the raid created a, quote, growing pain in the kosher community, the first big moment in kosher. Now kosher has to reflect the values in society. Ultimately, this was going to happen. And it's for the good, because we can have relatively inexpensive meat that doesn't have a stigma attached to it. Rabbinical authorities in charge of kosher standards, referred to as meshchigim, are developing a seal for ethical foods. The new and traditional stamps are called hekshesers. And please excuse my pronunciation. Even before the raid, Rabbi Morris Allen of Mendota Heights, Minnesota, started working on an ethical kashrut symbol called Megan Tzedek, which means seal of justice. He is director of the Heksher Tzedek Commission, which has worked to get the seal placed on products since 2006. He said that the commission hopes to have the seal on at least 3 products before Rosh Hashanah in September of this year. And the next story coming to us from abc.net.au, a little story about our friend Paul Watson. The headline is, Sea Shepherd Captain Arrested in Portugal. The captain of the anti-whaling ship, the Steve Irwin, has been arrested in Portugal on an outstanding 30-year-old arrest warrant. Paul Watson was arrested at Madeira Airport as he arrived for this week's meeting of the International Whaling Commission in Portugal. The Australian director of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, Jeff Hansen, says Mr. Watson was released after 4 hours of questioning. Quote, this warrant was actually issued back in 1980, which was in response to Sea Shepherd ramming and later scuttling the pirate whaler, the Sierra, he said. Then Paul had lengthy discussions with the police in northern Portugal, and they determined that the warrant had actually expired in 2008, so there was no valid reason to hold him. Mr. Watson says he was released after authorities discovered the warrant for his arrest had expired. Quote, a little surprised because I've come and gone in Portugal many times, and so suddenly why this happened, I don't know. But it was like last year in Chile. I was hassled a bit, and the Chileans told me it was because Japan had put in a complaint and they wanted to question me about what I was doing at the International Whaling Commission meeting. So I'm not quite sure if Japan was behind this, he said. And I think the final story today, coming to us from the Canadian Medical Association Journal, cmaj.ca, the headline is Harp Seal Heart Valves Being Tested for Human Use. Researchers in Quebec will soon begin testing heart valves from harp seals to determine if they are suitable for use in humans. Animal rights groups say the research is unnecessary and will serve only as government propaganda to promote Canada's sealing industry, which received a major blow on May 5th when Europe banned imports of seal products. The federal government projects that a commercial seal valve market could generate substantial revenue for Canada, but heart valve experts involved in the project say the research could lead to more than just financial gain. If their theory is proven true, if seal valves do offer significant advantages over existing bioprosthetic valves, the research could result in prolonged and improved lives of sufferers of heart valve disease. Quote, I'm optimistic that it could be superior to bovine or porcine valves, says Philippe Pibarot, Canada Research Chair in Valvular Heart Disease. Pibarot, a medical professor at Université Laval in Quebec City, obtained harp seal valves from Tamasu Incorporated in March 2008. Tamasu Incorporated is a producer of seal products. He hopes to test seal valves in animals, possibly sheep, within 3 years. Though human implantation may be 8 to 10 years away, Pibereau says the limited durability of valves made from pig and cow tissue make this research necessary. Quote, the anatomy and structure of seal valves are different. Their valves are thicker with more elastic fibers. They have a more robust structure because they are designed by Mother Nature to withstand harsher conditions. And that is the news for today. I actually had a few more news stories, but I will send those along to Neil to post them as links when this show is archived.
It's quite the collection of news stories.
Yeah, they're a bit, it's a bit of a mixed bag, I guess.
The stuff about the valves.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's, it doesn't surprise me because when every time that there's been a threat of a European ban on seal products, the government has magically found new avenues for those products or new sort of ways to promote seal products. And I was amazed that it was actually this quick and that it was a medical application. I'd never thought that seal products would go that way. Mm-hmm. It's usually been sort of finding different countries to export the products to, not really changing what the seal products would be used for, but this is something entirely new.
I wonder if it'll change the landscape of discourse about the seal hunt, because it's a collision now of the seal hunt controversy combined with all the debates about medical use of animals, mm-hmm. and that becomes such a powerful way of justifying various different types of
it's
animal
really,
exploitation.
It's really, really difficult, as you know, to argue against things that are ostensibly going to save people's lives, you know, because we like to think of ourselves as more valuable than other animals. And so if a harp seal heart valve can help a human stay alive, then that harp seal should probably feel proud that right. he or she made a contribution to.
And it's sort of, it's one of those sort of classic debates where it becomes fastened down into this dichotomy where you have to choose between the animal or the person. That's how the debate gets structured. So then you can only be on, it's as if you can only be on one side or the other instead of thinking about all the ways that there are probably other medical avenues. What are the underlying issues or causes of heart valve disease, etc.? So to put it in those terms becomes a very limited way of having the conversation. It is such a brilliant political move, mm-hmm. I think, in many ways.
Yeah.
We'll see. I mean, we'll follow it. We'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, I'm interested. I actually, after I found that story, over the last couple of days, I subscribed to the Canadian Medical Association Journal. I always find these stories in all sorts of different places, and then I end up subscribing to their lists, and all sorts of weird things pop up after that.
I do have one criticism about the news.
Tell me.
You didn't sound like me at all.
Well,
you really have to work on your voice.
I've been a bit sick. But I'm taking some pills to so that my voice gets higher.
To raise your voice. Yeah. All right. Okay, on that note, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back. We're going to talk about the new poster campaign that's been running in Toronto subway systems called Why Love One But Eat the Other. And we're talking to the coordinator today, Kimberly Carroll, who's also a television host and producer. You might have seen her before. She's done programs with the W Network, CBC Television, and radio, CTV, etc. And she's a very passionate human rights and animal rights, environmental issues activist. And we're really excited today to talk with her about these very provocative posters and some of the issues that underlie the posters, who has been involved, who did the design, what's been the reaction of Toronto citizens to these very controversial, interesting posters. So please stay tuned for that. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Our website is animalvoices.ca. And of course, we'd love you to join us on Facebook. You can befriend us there by going to facebook.com, keying in Animal Voices. And without further ado, we'll take a short break. We'll come back with Kimberly Carroll. Hi, welcome back to the show. As I mentioned before the short break, we're speaking today with Kimberly Carroll. We're really excited today to talk with her about the very provocative Why Love One But Eat the Other Toronto subway ad campaign that's been running. So I wanted to welcome Kimberly to the show. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Lauren. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being on the show. I know that you had to do some jigging of your schedule, so we appreciate you could be here.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime I can, help speak out for animals, I'm there.
You know, and it's great, too, because the campaign is such a good example of people really doing something creative, putting the message out there, and I think that you're such a great spokesperson for this kind of thing. So, as I said,
well,
I'm really happy.
Well, I hope so. You can judge again after we're done the interview.
Okay, well, we'll do the judging afterwards. I did just a short bio of you at the beginning of the program, and now as we've come back from the break, but if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about who you are and how you came to look at animal issues, that would be great.
Well, let's see. So, yeah, in my sort of normal life, I am a television host and producer and have been for many years. I've been a vegetarian for probably about 12 or 13 years. I'm come from Manitoba, which is farm country, and I considered myself an animal lover for my whole life. I have always had an amazing connection with animals. They truly make me connect to who I am and the world around me, and in my eating meat, I was responsible for hundreds of animals being killed and living tortured lives, at least a good 20-something years of my life. And it finally took, I'll tell you, the experience that turned me veg to begin with. I'm now vegan. I was at a friend's farm just after calving season, and I fell in love with two twin calves. And I just connected with them so much, and they were so beautiful and had so much personality already. And then we went in for dinner and proceeded to eat steak. Well, there was steak. I didn't eat it. And at that point, I just said to myself, Kimberly, your ethics have to outweigh your appetite at this point. You just cannot shut down this little voice in the back of your head saying, what are you doing? This is so wrong for you. So that's what started me on the veg road, 13 years ago. I've been a vegan for a few years now, and I've only really been an activist in the animal rights community for about maybe 2 or 3 years.
Hmm.
But I'm trying to make up for lost time. And I know that a lot of people in urban centers don't have the opportunity to connect with cows, pigs, and chickens firsthand. We're a society of people who, actually call ourselves animal lovers, but we only tend to extend that circle of compassion to the animals that are closest to us, our animal companions or animals that we, a bird that falls out of a tree or, for people that have sort of already discovered, wow, the dinner on our plate are also animals and have actually come to the point where that has changed their lifestyle. It's an interesting question to put out to people, and that's where the idea comes from of why I love one but eat the other.
Mm. Yeah, the word that you are using frequently to describe your own journey is connection. You're making the connection, and I think that that's something that's very strong, that features very strongly in this Why Love One But Eat the Other campaign, is to make a connection between maybe animals that we typically think of as being part of our family, for example, cats and dogs, and then linking that up with information in an image of an animal like a baby chick or a baby pig, a piglet, to make that connection between the loving of one and then of course, the animal that gets often disregarded and then put through the industrial food process and then becomes somebody's meal. And then from there, there's a connection to the bottom of the poster, which is really about exposing those factory farm conditions and making the connection between those two animals at the top of the poster to what's going on there in terms of food production.
Absolutely. I mean, you look around, and there's very few people that would say, if you ask them, if they like animals, would say, no, we're crazy about our dogs and our cats, and I know I am about mine. Yet, there are 665 million farmed animals killed for food in Canada each year, and that's 50 billion across the globe. That's just an astounding number that I don't think, I can't even wrap my head around. And over 95% of these animals in Canada, before being slaughtered, spend their lives on what we call factory farms, where they live an absolute nightmare. You know, thousands crammed into the dark, filthy sheds and intensive confinement in things like gestation crates and battery cages, mutilations without painkillers. And, I mean, these animals don't ever get to feel even the sun on their backs or breathe fresh air, you know, until the day that they are bound for slaughter. So my co-organizer of this campaign, Lisa Kramer, and I basically wanted to do two things with this campaign. We wanted to draw attention to the similarities between the animals we call family and the animals we call dinner, and then expose the shocking cruelty that animals raised for food in Canada face. And so for those that haven't seen the posters, there's three different ads featuring the three different sort of main farm animals that we're acquainted with. For example, we in the pig ad, we have a very cute piglet sort of facing a very cute puppy. And the line above is, "Why love one but eat the other?" And we go on then to talk about some of the things that you might not know about pigs. I mean, pigs are incredible animals. We talk about how the pig is the smartest domestic animal in the world. It even rivals some primates in cognitive abilities. And it actually has intelligence beyond that of a three-year-old human child. I mean, this is an animal we're eating on a regular basis and torturing before we eat. Pigs dream. They recognize their names. They're gregarious and affectionate, and they form loyal bonds with each other and humans. I was at Farm Sanctuary last summer, and they had three piglets that had come in during the same rescue. They weren't related, but these piglets had grown up with such a close bond with each other that when these pigs, full-grown, huge at the point I saw them, when they sleep with their snouts touching each other. They have to have that touch, that contact. And even when they'd roll over, they'd readjust so that their snouts would meet again. Mm. And to me, for people to connect with that aspect of these animals, that these are animals that have just as much character and personality as the dogs and cats that we love for good reason, because they're incredible beings. And so then in the poster, what we do is we show a strip of factory farming of this particular animal, and in the pig poster, of course, it'll be pigs in factory farming situations, and then talk about what the reality is for these animals, that they, you know, they endure a life of misery. They're cramped in dark warehouses. They, you know, have their tails cut off, their teeth clipped, they're castrated without anesthetic. Sows, mother pigs, are especially get the raw end of the deal. They're kept in what are called gestation crates, metal crates, so small that for most of their lives they can barely step forward or backward, and they can't even lie down comfortably. This is their life in a two-foot-wide crate, and they're kept constantly pregnant and will never have any quality of life whatsoever.
I want to take a short break there and then come back and hit you with some of the harder questions.
Absolutely.
About whether or not this is playing on people's heartstrings, if it's manipulating the public, all those sorts of maybe criticisms that this campaign would get. And of course, we want to hear more about people's responses to the Why Love One But Eat the Other campaign as well. So we'll come back with Kimberly Carroll on Animal Voices. Please stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we're speaking with Kimberly Carroll, who's the coordinator for the Why Love One But Eat the Other, I suppose co-coordinator with Lisa Kramer. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about the design of the posters and some of the information that is on those ads. And I wanted to ask you, Kimberly, because it seems like one of the things that you're sort of inherently rallying against with the posters is some of those negative assumptions that people have, or stereotypes that people have about farm animals. And you had mentioned that there's information that is countering something. There's this idea that, you know, pigs are actually very intelligent, that they have personalities, etc. And so there seems like it's about kind of challenging something that you and Lisa and other animal activists must be picking up on, that those animals that we use for food are often seen as not really having lives as rich or as complicated in emotional states, as rich and complicated as those animals that we do tend to have in our homes, like cats and dogs.
and that's one level, Lauren, and really we were trying to work on two levels with this poster. The one was to hit those people out there that are animal lovers, but just haven't managed to make the connection, and just haven't made that, extended their circle of compassion to farm animals. And so the top part of the poster are appealing to them. The factory farm information is appealing to those ethical consumers out there who, you know, are concerned about environment or concerned about fair trade, that really would be shocked to know what happens within the factory farm system. So really, that's what we're trying to cast a pretty wide net with these posters. Everybody responds to different aspects of animal protection and animal rights, and so we really wanted to do a poster, first of all, that was going to be aesthetically pleasing, was going to draw attention, and then was going to give people some, you know, some pretty cold hard facts if they chose to engage in it. And I have to say that is one of the aspects that has been, I think, really successful with this campaign. You know, it's human nature to, when we are confronted with something that somebody says, you are doing this wrong, I mean, we don't listen because we're too busy defending ourselves. You know, we put up those walls right away, and there's no dialogue, that true dialogue that happens, because we're too busy, you know, fending off an attack. So with these posters, it gives people the opportunity to choose to engage without any feeling of being attacked, without any feeling of somebody telling them they've been doing something wrong. And it's been really interesting to watch, because I mean, I quite enjoy riding the subways these days. And because I'll watch and I'll see somebody, you know, I saw this like big muscle-bound guy the other day, and he sort of started looking at the poster and then started to turn away, and then he went back again and started to, and then it was just like this back and forth, and he was like, I don't want, and then I do, and he was reading that poster for, you know, a good like 4 to 5 minutes as we rode. I think it works really well, and I'm not saying that there's not, you know, in this movement, and you know, to try and bring liberation for animals, there's room for everything. There's room for protest. There's room for a confrontation. But I think this is a really effective way of grabbing people in a very non-threatening way.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about strategy, and I know that Carl had some questions about that, but I wanted to talk just a little bit more about the design of the posters, because and doing this kind of work with the radio show for so many years, I feel like I've heard a lot of criticisms of the animal rights movements over the years, and one of them, and this comes up over and over again with the seal hunt, and I know that's something that you're quite passionate about too, in terms of protesting the seal hunt, is that there is often the concern that there's an overemphasis on baby animals, that there's going to be that animal rights activists are seen as only caring about the cute animals, and so I thought it was interesting that with the posters there was the choice to use baby animals as opposed to the mature adults. Can you talk a little bit about that choice?
In two of the posters, the pig and the chicken poster, we did choose the young animals on both sides, so we have a kitten with a chick and we have a puppy with a piglet. And then we have a full. We did decide for the third poster, we'd do an adult cow and an adult dog, just to mix it up. And obviously, we're, you know, temporarily in the ad business, and you know, what sells better than cute images? We use those cute images to draw people in, because, like I said, this is an image that makes people feel good. Oh, two baby animals, you know, and it does warm the heart. And then what we really wanted to do was juxtapose that with the horror of what really happens, not just, you know, with adult animals, but these are baby animals are being incredibly abused in the system right now. I was just at a livestock auction up in Woodville this past weekend, and with the head of investigations with the Canadians for Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, and they've got a bunch of kids, goats now, that are going out for halal slaughter, and just seeing these pens full of these tiny little kid goats, they're just the tiniest little things, and you know, the sounds of the screaming of these little animals as they're being taken to load on the truck to cart to slaughter, I mean, I'll never be able to erase that sound from my head. Mm. And so, yes, it is, it's manipulative, but it's the truth. Mm. And there's, what, maybe 3 to 5%, nobody seems to be able to decide on vegetarians right now in North America, the population. it's kind of us against the world in a lot of ways. And so, as far as I'm concerned, we need to use whatever tactics are effective to, you know, draw people. And nothing that we've used in those posters is false by any means. We had all the information, even though it sounds incredibly crazy and sensational. I mean, the stuff that we list that happens in factory farming, these are common factory farming practices in Canada. We had it checked and double-checked by many people on the know. We had lots of consultants on this. And the photos that we use are actual factory farming photos, and you know, some of them are from Canada. You know, for example, some people would look at the cow poster, and there is a picture in the cow poster of this cow with an incredibly massive udder. It looks grotesque, and people would go, "Oh, well, you just, you know, use the most sensational photo." This is par for the course with dairy cows that are being culled. If I can tell you the story about this gal, again, Twyla Francois, a head of investigations for CETFA, had come across this cow, who she named Emily, at a auction in Manitoba. And basically, she's a perfect example of a spent dairy cow. She would have spent her life being intensively milked by machines, kept continually pregnant, and having her calves taken away after only 1 to 2 days so as not to waste any milk on them, the milk that is supposed to be, you know, I'm using air quotes here, supposed to be used on humans. And dairy cows in Canada and the U.S. are genetically bred to produce 10 times the amount they naturally would. And this kind of strain on the body, it results in most dairy cows these days being spent by 3 years of age, and their natural lifespan is 25 years. So at around 3 years old, Emily would have been torn from her barn mates, loaded with electric prods onto a transport trailer, and then she was shipped to an auction market in Winnipeg to become junk meat or hamburger meat. And Emily had a particularly painful journey, as many cows with mastitis do, because this, you know, infection in her teats hadn't been treated. It eventually ruptured the ligaments, which held her udder in place, and she had a twisted stomach, which is excruciating. Even so, she was forced through the auction ring, and she was purchased by a slaughterhouse in, get this, Ontario. So here was this cow that was just in excruciating pain, and they were going to transport her the following week to Ontario. You can imagine the trip that would be. By day number 3, she went down. So she would have been considered a downed cow. And she was still in a pen with like 10 others. Basically, she was being trampled, you know, by the others to get to their food and everything. And still at that point, nobody was going to do anything. Well, Twyla worked for 3 days to try and get a vet to come and euthanize her. And again, I'll mention to those that, you know, want to, you know, should know where their meat is coming from, this was still a cow, a downed cow that was going to be put into the meat, meat distribution. So finally, a vet from the Agricultural Department of Manitoba put her down after 3 days of Twyla working at this. And here's the real kicker. This vet lost her job over this. So the state of this...
Can you say more about that?
You know, basically, she worked for the Agricultural Department of Manitoba, and those that work for the government and the agricultural sector, are their first priority is to the industry. And this was still a cow that somebody was going to make a few bucks off of. So, again, this baby kid goat that got taken away, that we were trying to get out of the system, that had lost its eye on the weekend, sold for $20, you know, and that was more than usual. And so it just brings attention to not only how much we devalue in every way the lives of these animals, but the terrible conditions from raising to auction, to slaughter, that farm animals go through. And it's all done behind closed doors that most people are not seeing. And so if we have to show them some shocking pictures, well, it's all shocking. We're not choosing ones that are particularly that shocking. We're just choosing ones that some undercover person managed to get at some point and represent many millions of other animals.
I can understand that desire to think that it's the worst cases. You know, your brain is sort of scrambling to make sense of the images and to protect yourself around feeling complicit in something that's so horrible. We only have about 15 minutes left, and Carl had a question about strategy, but I wanted to make sure that after that we talk a little bit more about the responses that you've heard from people. You mentioned the one guy, the muscled guy on the subway car, and his response. So I'm just wondering a little bit of the murmurs, some of the things that you've gotten heard back about the campaign. But before we do that, I'll turn it over to Carl, who wanted to ask about strategy.
Okay.
Yeah, hi, Kimberly.
Hey,
I'm just
Carl.
Wondering if you could maybe take us back to even before this campaign got off the ground. Why subway ads, and why decide to use resources like this? You mentioned all of a sudden being in the ad business, and I'm just wondering how the sort of decision to, as you say, get into the ad business was made, and why choose subway ads over other ads?
Well, you know, I'll be honest, Carl, it's all been pretty hit and miss. I'll just give you a little bit of background about how this campaign came to be. I had sort of heard of a donor here in Toronto who was interested in doing some sort of transit ads with the, I think it was the Henry Spiro quote, "Why pet one but eat the other?" And this an ad similar to that had run many years ago in Vancouver, and she wanted to see something done like this in Toronto. And so my original thought had been to just sort of line her up with somebody, a group, and have it done. And I mean, the more I got into it, the more I just went, I just really want to see this get done, and I really want it to be a good experience for our donor, because hey, there's a lot of things we could do, you know, in the future if we have somebody, a generous person who's willing to do more. And so we worked from that premise that we were probably going to use something like "Why pet one but eat the other," but we also were inspired by Mercy for Animals transit campaigns in the States. Mercy for Animals is a group run out of Ohio, and they have been really instrumental in helping us in this campaign. They've supplied us with advice. They've helped us, you know, with some ad sales work. They've helped supply a support website for the campaign, which is chooseveg.ca. And they've run campaigns about factory farming in Chicago, Boston, and currently in New York City. And they had a lot of success with it. Their campaign is quite different. They use the overhead posters, the long overhead posters, and their campaign is "How much cruelty can you swallow?" And it's strictly about factory farming. And so I guess it was very organic. We really, it wasn't until about 2 weeks before we had to submit the ads that we came up with the final design. Helen Prancic from Arc 2 was our wonderful graphic designer.
Yay! We love Helen.
She was fabulous. And, I mean, basically, we had just a little ragtag team of people that I brought together. I didn't make necessarily conscious choice, but there was a part of me that, you know, in Toronto, in the animal rights or animal protection community, there are so many groups, and everybody crosses over, and everybody helps everybody else. And I just really wanted to sort of bring some people from different contingents in to help on this campaign. And so Helen was amazing there. We had somebody from the Toronto Vegetarian Association, like I said, CETFA, and the Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals helped out a bit. So it really was organic, you know. It really was grassroots. And, you know, we basically had this sort of chunk of money that wasn't that much money to start with, but Mercy for Animals were able to negotiate us some pretty good ad space. And then basically there was just thousands of dollars of donated time put into this project.
Mm.
All donated time. Yeah, so that's kind of the background of how that happened. I mean, we all sort of pulled from our different resources. I know an ad person, so I'll check with them to see, you know, how to do this. I know somebody who's a consultant in this business, well, you know. And then our decision to do the subways I'm assuming Subway's as opposed to the entire system, Carl?
Subway's as opposed to any other, you know, as opposed to newspaper. I know newspaper ads are insanely expensive.
Garbage bins.
You know, garbage bins or magazines or anything like that. Okay. Radio ads, for example.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, well, it's pretty simple. As I mentioned before, there was that sort of non-confrontational element that really appealed to us about the Subway. We only have them in Subways because we just felt that the traffic was higher there and that people spend more time just sort of standing mm-hmm. on Subways. And I just, you know, through personal experience, I just find that when there is a Subway ad, like on Subways, people are looking for stuff to do. They're looking for stuff to engage in. And so if you give them something that they can really sink their teeth into, they're likely to read the entire thing. And also, we wanted to get buzz going. We wanted this to be something that really touched a really large mass audience of Toronto public. The stats say that the campaign will get 475,000 views per day. That's pretty big. And then there's the element of, I was started noticing a few months ago that there were a lot of blank spaces on the TTC mm-hmm. for ads. And I thought, this is going to be a good time to try and hit them up. And from what I understand from a couple of the different groups in town, they've tried to get animal rights type ads on the TTC in it, and they've never gotten accepted. So this is...
Do you know why?
No, I don't know. And I can guess that... you know, it was too controversial, and they weren't the TTC weren't willing to take that risk. But possibly now, because ad sales are so low, that they are willing to take a risk, or we just had the kind of poster that was just the right balance for them to be able to slide it through.
Mm.
We were pretty happy when they approved them, believe me.
Yeah.
We weren't sure if that was going to happen. So, so our hats off to the TTC for giving us a forum.
Mm-hmm. They're nice looking posters. They really are.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's the difference. I mean, we did have some criticisms from some animal rights folks that were like, "Oh, there's not enough gore, and it's got to be bigger." And and it's just not that. We don't want to preach to the converted. We want to grab a whole audience of people who've never thought of this stuff before.
Mm.
You know, and these aren't bad people. These are people mostly that just have never thought of the issues. Mm. You know. And, Lauren, you're asking about reactions, and I mean, it's really been amazing. We have reports pouring in from all sorts of folks in the community saying that they overheard people at work talking about it. I've heard of whole families turning veg because of it. We've got messages through our website and Facebook pages that have said this campaign has turned us veg. Just this morning I heard from a volunteer from the Toronto Vegetarian Association. They had had a booth at Pride this past weekend. And several people approached her for information saying that the ad campaign had inspired them to go veg.
Mm.
So that's amazing. We've also had requests from folks around the world, like from Hong Kong to Slovenia, asking about using these poster designs for their own campaigns in their own countries. And so we're basically saying this is open source. We just want people to print out the posters where they can. There's high-res PDFs of each of the posters online. We're going to work with animal protection organizers here in Canada and beyond to adapt the posters for their use. So, I mean, it has been amazing, you know, amazing response. You know, of course, some, as I say, feathers have been ruffled. The Global News actually did a piece on the ad campaign a couple of weeks ago, and negative reaction came from one of the oddest of places I can think of. They went to a smaller family farm to get the opposing side of what this campaign is all about, and they interviewed a farmer who said the whole thing was underhanded business. And then right after that, Hugh Coghill, the chief inspector for the OSPCA, decided to show up at the farm and speak out against the campaign. This campaign, I might add, is about drawing attention to cruelty to animals, which is what that organization is supposed to be about. And he basically said, we raise livestock species for consumption, and that's their intent, and that's what we're raising them for, and we're not raising kittens for consumption, so I, you know, see a distinct difference between them. And I just went, why is the head, and you know, chief investigator for the OSPCA spending valuable time speaking out against a campaign that is about bringing awareness to cruelty for animals?
Mm.
So anyway, I know that I, in my mind, I decided that I will never donate again to the OSPCA, and I especially, I think it was last week, you had somebody from the OSPCA on, and I just remember thinking, wow, their mandate is to prevent cruelty to animals, so it just seemed like a crazy misuse of the OSPCA's time.
Mm. Do you think it would be fruitful, or would you be interested in speaking directly with Hugh about that position?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suspect that he didn't actually see the full poster, that he just was told the tagline, and he, you know, decided to comment according to that. But yeah, absolutely, I'd speak to him. I was planning on contacting him.
It really speaks, I think, to some of the historical precedents and the ways that humane societies, protection societies, and then animal rights and animal liberation movements and organizations have parted ways. I've also done research into some of those histories and looked at that fear that some of the organizations, I'm not saying this is the position of Hugh, but some of the fear that these organizations can have that they'll lose their membership if they if they're seen as going too far in their widening of circles or to include those food animals in their mandate, that it's seen as being too radical.
Oh, it's a tightrope act, you know, really. A lot of these organizations, and I'm not saying the OSPCA, but a lot of organizations and a lot of people are employed by the industry, and as much as they might want to help animals, their hands are bound, you know, just like that vet working for the Manitoba Agricultural Department. You know, I think people need to realize that these organizations that they think are out for animals, you know, they have to really look at what are the alliances, where are these people's loyalties truly, and where do these loyalties begin and stop? Because, oh yeah, so we prevent cruelty to animals who are pets, but we don't care about farm animals. In fact, we're buddies with the farmers, so we're actually going to defend the farmers. So it's definitely murky territory.
Yeah. And something like these posters is really about blurring those boundaries, the distinctions that we often think of between farmed animals, lab animals, companion animals, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of, I think, security is placed in that those categories are fairly fixed and solid, and that we understand who animals are in those categories. And then this kind of campaign or this kind of approach is about blurring those boundaries, showing really how those ideas are really constructions, and actually there's much more continuity between people and non-human animals, between farm animals and animals that are often considered pets, etc. So,
I mean, just because an animal has been designated a certain use doesn't erase its personality or its capacity for love or suffering or pain, you know? And I mean, Canada has one of the worst farming records out there, worse than the U.S. In fact, many states in the U.S. are miles ahead of us in animal welfare reforms. And we're certainly far, far behind the European Union. We still have intensive confinement systems like battery cages for egg-laying hens and veal crates and gestation crates for pigs, whereas the EU has already implemented a ban on all these systems. The Canadian Federation of Humane Societies actually just said recently that Canada's record in farm animal welfare is shameful, and we lag well behind the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, and the European Union.
We don't have really any more time left, but I wanted to make sure to thank you again very much for coming on the program, and also to turn it over to you if there's a website that you quickly want to give before we go off the air.
Absolutely. So you can check out more about the campaign and any supporting information you need for Going Veg at www.chooseveg.ca. And on there is also our Facebook link to our Facebook group. And we're also going to be we're looking around for donations to be able to extend this campaign, too. So if anybody out there is listening and they have got money burning a hole in their pocket, then email us at info@chooseveg.ca.
Thank you so much, Kimberly.
Thank you, Lauren.
And thanks for your work on this campaign.
My pleasure. It's just great to be able to do something that has a high impact.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Kimberly Carroll, who is one of the coordinators for the Why Love One But Eat the Other Toronto Subway ad campaign. Dos Mundos coming up. Sergio. It'll be a good show. Thanks for listening to Animal Voices. Thanks, Carl, for bringing us news.